was Kershaw tipping pitches. CJ, how does the hitter see that and take advantage?
Well, first and foremost, Chris, if it did happen, it always happens when the pitcher is in the stretch. Rarely can you pick up pitches when a guy is thrown from the windup, and that's what we saw in that seventh inning.
All right, Alex, we're back today with our second half of our interview with Fernando Perez. If you missed the first half, it came out a couple days ago. It's episode 21, and we talked a lot about Fernando Perez, for those of you who don't know, former MLB player, spent most of his career, most of his pro career with the Tampa Bay Devil Rays.
I hope you know who he is. It's a little weird if you only listened to part two of this interview. If you were just like, I see part one and part two, and I'm just going to dive right in halfway
some people,
through.
I don't know. Some people's podcast apps put him in the reverse chronological.
Yeah.
I don't know. Whatever. So just giving you the requisite background. But anyway, if you missed it, go back and listen to it. It was really great to talk to him about like, scouting and GMs and decision making and the ways that we train baseball players and practice and that kind of thing. It was awesome. But in this half, we get a little bit more into kind of his personal life and writing and how that has interacted with baseball. And then, we finish up with some fun stories and just some really good shooting the shit moments, I feel like.
Yeah, so I don't know if we mentioned this on the podcast, but like how much we talked about it, but he went to Columbia and was like really involved in a lot of writing endeavors while he was there, and it's not something that he dropped when he went into baseball. And so I was just kind of curious about the interplay with that and kind of how he carried that with him as he went on. And obviously he's still doing a lot of writing now, and we'll definitely link to that in the description, some of his more recent work. But yeah, we just wanted to know the life of a former Major League Baseball player now. What's he up to?
Who's also like a professional level writer and like an incredible person and really entertaining.
Yeah. Also on this podcast, he informally pitches us to Vice. So there you go. There you have it. We basically work for them now.
Strap in. It's a good one. And we hope you enjoy the rest of the interview.
I want to shift a little bit to, we've talked a lot about baseball. We will continue to talk about baseball. But I know that one of your other really big interests is poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been pretty well documented. I know you've given interviews about it and you've published your own works. I'm just kind of curious where that interest comes from, especially as someone who is you do a lot of writing. Mm-hmm. You did writing as a ball player. And so kind of how those things work with each other and how that plays out in a clubhouse as someone who is open about the fact that you have other interests besides baseball, just because I know it's a very conservative, kind of keep your head down type sport. And so what it's like to be someone who is like, yes, I am not just a one-track mind. I only see the ball and hit the ball.
Yeah,
right?
Like it says right here on your Wikipedia page, not to make you uncomfortable that we have your Wikipedia page open. But like, you are a fan of poets Robert Creeley and John Asbury. Like, do people in the clubhouse come up and say, hey, like, I read a Robert Creeley poem once?
No, there's like a little bit of fucking with you for sure. Actually, there's a great heckling story. Heckling stories are incredible, and you should ask people more about these heckling stories. In fact, I was in a clubhouse maybe a year and a half ago because I wanted to write a story about heckling for Vice. And so I started asking people heckling stories. So a couple fascinating ones. I asked Dallas Keuchel. And Dallas Keuchel, he looked at me just like, I've never heard any heckling ever. And I was like, whoa, you're ice in your veins, bud.
Well, he needs to listen to one of our previous podcasts.
He might just be like, it just might be true, you know?
On our all gentrification team.
Yes.
Where we just picked baseball players that looked like they could gentrify Brooklyn.
Yeah, yes.
They were our next-door neighbors in Bushwick.
Yeah.
Drink their craft beer.
What an extraordinary player. That was a funny thing. So I was in the Astros clubhouse. Carlos Gomez told me that the A's were the worst. He said that he gets crushed by the A's.
Yeah.
And look, there's another, when you're not a white guy, there's another layer to heckling that people don't really realize. It's not just like, It's not like, hey, Nick Swisher, you suck, man. It's like, you know, I'm running. I'll give you one. I'm running out in Columbus, Ohio. I'm running out to right field and I hear, hey, boy, we're going to have a good time today. And I was like, it's the first inning.
Oh, my God.
The heckling story, though.
Also,
I would like
that wasn't shockingly accurate to what it might sound like.
Probably.
Yeah, it's like you ask a guy like Adam Jones about that sort of thing.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, totally. The heckling story, this is a lighthearted one. I was in Louisville. And I'm going out to play left field in 2010 in Louisville. And I think, I mean, star-studded. Aroldis Chapman's there. I watched Matt Joyce hit like a 800-foot home run off of Aroldis Chapman. Good times were had by all. Daniel Ray Herrera was there, who also lives in Brooklyn. You guys should talk to him. The shortest pitcher, I might add, since 1960 something. And I do, when he comes to my house and I like introduce him like that to people, he's like, this is Daniel Ray Herrera, the shortest pitcher since 1960.
I'm sure he appreciates that. Does he introduce you as the player who had the most injuries over the course of his career? The most weird injuries?
I don't know what he introduces me as. So anyway, I'm out there and these guys, they have internet access and they pulled up a piece of writing that I published. And they read it. They read the whole thing. And it was so beautiful. It was so stylishly done. I hope this guy like hears this at some point because it was so incredible. I bowed to him. I bowed to him after the game was over. It was just 9 innings of this shit. He read it and he would read lines and he's like, actually, Fernando, I find that line actually quite pedantic. And just like things like that over and over. It was so good. It was one of the best heckling stories ever. I would definitely like play with them a little bit more, but you know, like especially like in the minor leagues and the major leagues, just, you know, it's like don't do anything that makes anyone uncomfortable. Whereas like it was the minor leagues and I remember like, you know, kind of like getting in it with other people. Poetry. I've always written. I don't know when it started, but I've always written it. I've never really looked at it as a very, very special thing. I always looked at it like a thing that somebody does. Like people sneeze, people pee, some people write. Why write? Why poetry specifically? It's always been interesting to me because of the lack of rules. I have horrible syntax and I always found like a lot of like writing rules like very, very oppressive. Now, this also made me unreadable for a high school teacher. I mean, I was talking to a high school teacher of mine. I was just like, oh, that must have been so annoying when I was just like, I'm going to try to write an essay that's one sentence because I saw a poet do that one time. Or like, you know, I'm supposed to turn in a 20-page research paper and it's just like several sestinas or something annoying like that. But it just like always was interesting to me. And then really how all of this began, I mean, the way I told the story like this is totally true. The way that Mark McGuire's Andro was found, they saw it in his locker. And there was for me, it was like a slow news day. I was in spring training or I just got called up or something. And a writer sees all these skinny books of poetry in my locker and a very simple reason for them. During baseball season, it's such a long season. My stamina to read a thing that where I'm going to be in a chapter for like a while, it's just hard. I can't I don't think I read many novels or long things at all when I was playing baseball. But the short sort of flirt with poetry of reading a thing and having a feeling from it very, very quickly and having it be over, it was sort of perfect for the schedule. And it's really all it was. It could have been at a different point in the season, it would have been all totally different books or something like that. And that's how that, you know, that whole thing began. And then, of course, just because of where we are culturally, like it became a thing. Like, oh my God, this guy plays baseball and he reads books. Oh my God, let's write a story. Oh my God. And you know, it's just like, I was like, you know, had to sort of like let that kind of take its course and happen. But
also like Ivy League educated, I'm sure that played into it too.
Yeah. I mean, there was a scenario, there was a thing that happened. I remember I was interviewed by the Columbia paper. And this guy said to me, he said, you know, do you think that you're going to be treated differently in baseball? And I was just like, what? I was like, I don't even want to register an answer to that stupid ass question. And he was right. So he had probably spoken to other, he just knew. And it was a thing. Now, it depends who you are. There are guys that didn't go to Ivy League schools, but they're just like, they're just assholes. Like, they don't get along with their teams. Like, they just kind of think that they're better or for whatever reason. And, you know, I don't have much of that in me. But there was a thing where I had a coach at a point where he pushed my buttons over and over and over. And I know this is true because he told me he did it. He told me that he did it because he wanted to see what I was made of. We almost fought on a field. So, and in my head, I'm like, why aren't you teaching me how to hit? Why aren't you teaching me how to hit? So in his mind, he's just like, you know what I'm going to do? It's like, we got this guy, Ivy League guy. He's soft. I'm going to push his buttons. And I think he was a little bit surprised. I mean, he said something to me, kind of like kept challenging me. And I was like, I think this is the point. I've never been like a, you know, a violent person, but I was like, I think this is the point where I'm supposed to say, no, fuck you, man. You know, so I did. And, you know, it was like very like theatrical. Like, we were separated. And then he apologized. He apologized. You know, he apologized. He's like, I just wanted to see what you were made of.
Performative scuffles. I don't understand like that.
The performative scuffle, yes.
I don't understand like the intuition for athletes and baseball players specifically. Maybe like football is a different thing and that's a whole different conversation. But for like baseball players to be able to be like dropped off in a desert in war, like why is that like testing your valor as opposed to like just teaching you how to hit, like you said?
Because it's just what exists. It's like what they did before, and everybody's just doing what they did before. And you know, all my interest is to like design. So work from the task and work backwards without any regard to the past. Like, I know that this is what you guys did before. You used tees and you took batting practice and you did all of these things. So let's just not do any of that. There's no regard to the past. What is that doing for us? You know, it's very easily executable, but there's a lot of stuff. Now, there are some things that I think are valuable about that whole, that, you know, that mentality. And with, you know, guys that are, you know, quote unquote soft. And soft is a very interesting idea because, you know, when you're talking about, you know, these sort of like archaic, what can be, let's say, archaic baseball minds, they might think that if you are a homosexual, that you're soft and that you could field a baseball team of gay players, an all-star team of gay players. I'm sure. I mean, I'm actually plagiarizing that from a baseball writer. I don't remember who said it. You know, there are gay UFC fighters that would whoop your ass. So like, that's like not really true. Softness is a totally, totally different thing. But I think that there's some value in that when it comes to problem solving. For instance, we all know that we've worked with a person who you tell them to do a thing, and rather than use their reason to figure out that thing, they're just kind of like peppering you with questions about like trying to like wiggle out of the responsibility to do it. So I think that that could translate physically. And there are people like that. There are people that like when the going gets tough, they're going to kind of like wither a little bit. You don't really want guys like that on your team. Can you work on that? I do believe that you can work on that. You know, that's what a lot of those programs are like designed to do. I mean, one of the things that I said, you know, would it be of value to like make your whole baseball team do a survival course together? Like, possibly. I think it's the Falcons or something like that. They do that. They have these contractors, the Atlanta Falcons, or I know a football team does it. They have these contractors, these guys that have gone through like, you know, SEAL training, and it's all team building stuff. And it makes more sense in football. Football's a legitimate team sport. Baseball's not really a team sport. But it does make sense. Like, yeah, put these guys through like this crazy SEAL training where they have to rely on each other to do all these things. Like, yeah, that makes total sense. And I do think that you can take a player that is sort of dainty and soft and toughen him up in the right ways. And I think that that would be of value, but it's usually wrong-headed in the same way. Like, a good example is if you think of a bad parent, the kid does wrong, and the bad parent, because their parent yelled at them, they yell at their kid. It's like, oh, of course, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to yell at you and be mad at you. The idea that there's another way to get to your goal is like sort of foreign to them. And that goes on in baseball. There are people that work in baseball that are bad with people and shouldn't be working with your best players. You know, there are others that are great. And a lot of times they're allocated in bizarre sorts of ways. You know, sometimes like your best coach, one of the greatest guys I've ever met in baseball, his name is Manny Castillo. And I don't know where he is with Tampa now, but I learned how to switch hit when I was 24 or 25. And Manny helped me so much.
Quite late to the party there.
Yeah.
With the switch hitting.
Yeah, very late to the party. Manny helped me so much, but the thing why I think that he's been sort of like lost in the shuffle, there are a number of reasons. I think that a lot of times managers coaches, a lot of times if there are Latin coaches, they sort of just tend to get allocated toward the younger Latin players because they're part of it is like acclimating them to America. And maybe that is the best thing. But the skill that Manny had was explaining things physically that were hard to explain. So if you're not every coach clearly is super articulate and explaining things. So a good example, I think I mentioned this before, is that you'll have a guy that, you know, you're told, you know, you got to stay inside the ball forever. You hear it for 30 years. And then a guy who says he like walks into the locker room after, a thing in the cage, like a session in the cage, is like, I finally understand what staying inside the ball means.
Hey, wait, what does that mean?
Okay. So
one sentence.
So one sentence, staying inside the ball is having your bat between you and the ball. That may be a bad way to explain it. You know, I have a bat somewhere and I could get up and start to explain it. But it can't, I don't know if it can be explained in a sentence. It has to be like proved over and over and over. So what I want to do is I want to show you so many videos of guys doing it and not doing it. Like I want to sit you in a room just like we're sitting right now and show you all these videos. I don't want to be in a cage with 25 guys and say, yeah, you got to stay inside the ball, and have everybody nod their head and have three guys actually know what I mean. But that happens all the time. There are all these sort of these learning environments that aren't really controlled. And there's a lot of nodding your head. There's like a lot of like, there's like a pressure to say, I mean, we've been in classrooms where, you know, the teacher's like, is everybody with me? And everybody's like, yeah. And who's with them? Yeah. The point is we all want to be there. Because we're not taking a test to like, you know, have the best grades at NYU for a job. Like we're all trying to play in the league. We really want everybody to know. And you really want to know this thing. You want to know what it means. So yeah, I'll just stop there.
I want to ask, you wrote quite a few years back a piece about walk-up songs.
Yes.
And like how you chose you said you chose the Price is Right song.
Yes.
Which is fantastic. Amazing.
It's incredible. It's worth a re-listen out there if you're listening
I'm going to play it at some point while editing this podcast.
But the extended version, make sure. Like the extended version is just like, holy shit, did Quincy Jones do? Actually, I feel like Quincy Jones might have actually done it. It would make sense if he did, because it's incredible.
I'll be very impressed if
like the
if
extended
this is right.
Version. It's just like, holy shit, this is deep.
You want to talk about shooting your shot right there with that prediction?
But you kind of say at the end of the piece that at a certain point it's mostly for the fans, right?
Yeah.
But I'm curious, kind of in your years over just in the locker room talking with guys who believe in this sort of thing, who believe that the walk-up song makes them better, or they just have something that they do. What are, I don't know, the weirdest rituals or things that guys, superstitions that guys have that they truly believe? Because that's one of the things that I feel like people talk about with baseball so much is like, you know, I do not wash my high socks until the next time we lose. So what's like the weirdest
one? I didn't wash anything.
Yeah.
Straight up nothing.
Yeah. I'm not sure if this qualifies, but I really like this one. Did you guys remember Grant Balfour and what he would do on the mound?
Of course, yes.
Okay. So that. Now, and he's not the most fascinating one. The best one that I've ever seen, I don't know the guy's name, but he's a left-handed pitcher, left-handed reliever that I remember facing him in Durham. You know, I'm right now, as I'm thinking about it, I'm just seeing him on the mound. I'm on second base, and I'm looking at him, and I'm like, what the fuck is this guy doing? So he's doing the Grant Balfour, where he like turns in to look, and he's just cursing. He's like, motherfucker, motherfucker, cursing, over, like, under his breath, right? So I was playing in the playoff game against the White Sox where I guess Orlando Cabrera had never seen that before. He didn't know Grant Balfour did that. And Grant Balfour doesn't mean any disrespect. It's just what he does to, like, get himself psyched up to throw his 95. He doesn't mean any disrespect. Orlando Cabrera didn't know this. They almost got into a little fight.
Yeah.
So this guy, apparently, so I asked like the second baseman. I mean, you know, the thing, one of the things that I miss the most is just casual conversations on the field, you know, with players on the other team. And I was asking him, and he's just like, he imagines that the quadrants of the strike zone are deer that he's trying to like hunt with his bow. And I was like, that's interesting. So like, that's his shit. I don't know. He started that. I'm also baseball. I'm also very, very much into, I think, a movement totally spearheaded by Mariano Rivera. What you do when you gather for your pitch. Okay. So like, start to picture some of these, right? You know, Brian Wilson, he did his like, you know, what is that? Red Bull Chic? I don't know what that is. But a guy who I like right now is Craig Kimbrell. Like, what's he doing? The chicken wing kind of thing. So what is he doing? He has an idea of what he's doing. I don't know if anybody's ever asked him. Like, he developed it, you know? But so what is he doing? Is he, like, doing, like, a light shoulder workout before the pitch that is actually, like, priming, like, actually priming his shoulder and protecting it while he throws his unnaturally hard fastball.
Keeping his labrum and rotator cuff engaged.
Yeah, like maybe that's what he's doing. I don't know.
So it works.
Guys, it works. It's working. Like,
whatever
he's doing. That's what he's doing.
And for Kershaw as well, like the over the head, like cat, like gather yourself, take a breath thing. Yeah.
So everybody's got a little something. And I know, you know, pitching wise, you know, when I pitched, I just wasn't very good. So I did those things because, like, I thought that a hitter might be like, whoa, that's weird, and, like, miss a pitch or something like that. But I just love that sort of thing, and I love the process of guys figuring it out. Like, you know, what made Gary Sheffield start trying that? What makes these guys, like, you know, Craig Counsell, where he's just like, you know what, I think I need to put my bat all the way over my head. I love that because it's a superstitious sort of thing, but usually it's like a physical superstition. It's just like, oh, this thing, this trigger gets me ready to hit. And it's really fun as a player to kind of develop them as you go. This is actually one of the things that I sort of want to break down in this, you know, this program that I'm proposing, because if you know, we go into the cage, you have an idea about hitting. You think that, you know, putting your bat where it is and putting your feet where they are, you think it helps you in some sort of way. And what happens with players is that they, and this may sound crazy, but it's totally true, that a lot of players, they believe that when they get out, it's like, oh, now I know what I need to do with my stance. And so we see guys change their stances. They make adjustments throughout the season. Cal Ripken made them within games. And so a lot of times it's injury stuff. You know, I remember a point where it's like, wow, my shoulder hurts so much that I need to maybe like keep my hands really low or something like that. So there's all sorts of reasons, but also guys are trying on stuff that is working. In the Evan Longoria years, when he was the greatest player in the world and we were playing together in Tampa, I cannot tell you how many players tried the like super Cas softball player stance that Longoria was sporting. Guys were just trying it because they all work. All the bats work. All the stances work. 99% of guys, if I'm teaching hitting as I've done a little bit, is like, you can do whatever the fuck you want before, but 99% of hitters, when the pitcher is, you know, about to release the ball, they all look exactly the same. It's just physics. So that whole plight is really fascinating to me. All that I want to do is I want to teach to players that they can hit in many, many different ways. Because a lot of times, if you'll see players, and this is not a losing attitude player, but like a guy who is maybe like a little bit like less on confidence and more on process. I can think of several players that I played with that like thought themselves out of baseball. They didn't believe in their ability, and they're just like, no. Like the reason that I'm failing right now is because my bat is like 1 inch over here. And if I move it 1 inch, that's probably not it. You're an incredible improvisational athlete. Baseball players are the greatest improvisational athletes. Like you can hit, I guarantee if I made you hit like Craig Counsell, like you can probably get some hits eventually. So my whole point is I just want to challenge guys to hit in as many different stances as possible and ritualize it. So they sort of lose that like, you know, wanting to cling to that like comfort blanket of like the stance that they think is best for them. They all work.
I wanted to just kind of wrap up on some of your media stuff and some of your recent media stuff. I think first and foremost, maybe the most important question that I'm going to ask you during this whole interview and podcast is, what's harder to hit, a 95 mile an hour fastball or a pitch from that wiffle ball tournament that you did a piece at?
That was hard. That's the whiff. And also what was lost in the translation there, just because, you know, it wasn't like a 40-minute documentary, it was just like a 10-minute one, is that that was medium pitch. What exists in wiffle ball is hard pitch. So they are actually, it's like an unspoken gentleman's rule that this is medium pitch. So if a guy is throwing it too hard, you can say, hey, that's too hard. So guys are all...
That would never work for me.
Yeah. Guys are all kind of like getting close. But when they're throwing it hard, it's a one hitter every time, and it's a 1-0 game. Like somebody just hits a lucky home run and it's over. So this was medium pitch.
Somebody just stumbles into one.
Yeah, it's medium pitch. The wiffle ball, because there's no fear of God. You ever hit in the shadows when... It's like, you know, a relief pitcher whose elbow hurts and he's missing arm side and you're not switch hitting anymore because you're not good at switch hitting and you're hitting righty-righty. And again, there are shadows. And then the owner of the stadium doesn't like the way the batter's eye looks. So he just canceled the batter's eye. And so the ball is the same color as the brick. And so that's the worst case scenario ever, and that's worse than hitting a wiffle ball, I would say.
Who was the scariest? I'm always curious about this because we've talked about it personally, but like, who is the scariest person that you would not stand in the box for? Like, who was the scariest person you ever had to stand in the box for? Like, fear of God level might hit you in the face scary.
It's somebody that I just like thought didn't like me or something. I would just say I could just tell you pitches. Like Johnny Venter's fastball is to this day the greatest pitch that I have ever seen in my life. So I faced him in AAA and he walked me on 4 pitches and I think he came out of the game pretty soon. What he was doing to the ball, I like to think of it this way. What he was doing to the ball was so unnatural and was so incredible that it was unsustainable and he ruined his arm. He found a way to make his ball move, and he ruined his arm over it. And if you think about that as an idea, you have more and more, you know, bullpen guys that are thinking that that's like kind of worth it. Now, there are so many reasons. There's a guy that I worked with at Major League Baseball. His name is Mike McClellan. And the smartest thing that he ever said about the smartest thing that I've ever heard said about the epidemic of arm surgeries was the fact that the new thing is the sticky mound, the sticky substance on the mound, which puts even more stress on an elbow. Whereas before it was more of like a sandy fall. You know, you step in kind of a sandy thing and it's just less stress on your arm. But now you've got this stickiness and you know, maybe that's not true, and it's literally that there's just more money at stake and more guys are trying harder to throw harder, and then also you have hitters getting better and better and better, so you have more guys that are trying to do anything they can to not throw the ball straight. I mean, I can't even remember many straight balls that I ever saw, you know, and even in like lower minor leagues. It's like if you're if you're throwing 97 and it's straight, like, what's that? That's not good enough. So if you're thinking about guys just putting English on the ball and things like that, I'm assuming that that's what it is. But Johnny Venter's fastball, by far, pitch by pitch, what's the guy? AJ Burnett's curveball is unhittable if he throws it right. You just don't swing at it. I remember I faced him in Yankee Stadium, and he threw a curveball, and it was right down the middle, and the umpire called it a ball. Molina asked the umpire where it was, and the umpire said it was down. I went into the video room, and it split the middle of the middle quadrant. Like, it just curved too hard. He didn't see it.
That's like Fangraph's worst called ball and worst called strike of the year that they
do. Yes. So, yeah, Venters. I got a chance to face Roy Halladay in spring training, and that was, you know, he was only throwing them at, like, 92, but they're bowling balls. Like, you hit it and your bat recoils so much. It's just hard to hit. It's not fun to hit. Guys throwing like hard two seamers, it isn't like a great time. It's just not that fun. Whereas I could hit knuckleballers for my whole life. It's like the greatest fun. You know, it's like all bets are off. Nobody cares if you're bad, really.
Nobody cares if you look stupid.
You know,
because
it's like
there's
just fun.
Yeah,
it's just
there's
fun.
There's a built-in like excuse for it.
Yeah.
The knuckleball is like the logical conclusion of weird baseball. Like, that's just everything yes. that it aspires to be.
Yeah.
It's like no one knows where it's going to end
yeah.
up.
Yeah, I actually strike out in the knuckleball movie. Because I managed to get some like very bullshit like Derek Jeter punching Judy hit through the right side to lead off the game, and then he retired 27 straight. So I had to strike out, of course, at the end of the game.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, I wanted to ask, like, because you do stuff on MLB Network and you also do stuff on Vice that's like a little bit longer. I wanted to ask, like, what do you enjoy about each thing separately? Because I'm always very interested in like the TV style shows where you're just like sitting around and someone just like tease you up, 90 seconds, go. And I feel like not everyone has the ability to do that and translate what they're trying to say really quickly. And, you know, we've been sitting around talking for like an hour and a half, but you don't get that luxury on a show like that. Whereas like at Vice, you get longer pieces, 12-minute documentaries, 40-minute style things. I'm wondering what appeals to you about each and like how do you have to change your mindset about the two?
What appeals to me about baseball media is the money. And I'll be very honest about that because the whole, when it comes to all of that stuff, ESPN-y, MLB Network, all of that stuff, it's all based on the supposition that this is really important. And it isn't important. Like net neutrality is actually important. And I don't want to get too far into like soft news and the decline of the empire, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to do that right now, but
I appreciate that you called it the empire.
There's a problem.
As someone who studied American studies.
We could go for another 2 hours on American exceptionalism alone.
we'll have you in the studio for that one.
Yeah.
It'll be a follow up.
But, you know, one of the things that I think people find annoying about all of this stuff is that there's going to be a show tonight, whether there's anything to talk about or not. And we're going to put you guys through this show, you know, and media, that's what media does. And that's like sort of the thing in the end that is like kind of disingenuous about it. It's like, we have to have a show today. So what are the most interesting things to talk about? Like, it's not as if it's like, oh, it's baseball was not interesting enough to have a show today. We're just going to show you Planet Earth 2 videos. That's not what happened.
I would appreciate that.
I would appreciate it too.
Just like honesty.
I would appreciate it too. And I will take this time to pitch for the 89th time to Vice, a show, a sports show.
We're just going to tweet this at Vice.
A sports show. A sports show that that gives sports news with the tone that is appropriate, right? Here we are, three people in this room. We love baseball. I love baseball. But I would never, ever sit here and try to tell you that Alan Trammell getting into the Hall of Fame is like at all more or as important as net neutrality or like the war in Yemen. But that is not the experience of going over to ESPN. It's just like, it's like, yo, LeVar Ball. LeVar Ball, though. LeVar Ball. So that's an issue. And I think that that's a reason that many reasonable
are so
people
annoyed
with all of that programming. I don't think that it's the, you know, I think that in a way, like Skip Bayless sort of personifies it in a way, but it's, I don't think that that's what people are annoyed about and are sort of driving away from these things. It's more just like, it's like how, but how important is this though? Like, I think that people are looking at sports like many different things. Like sports is as important as tech news and as business news and as this and as this and this. It's like sort of like, you know, like the, if you watch Al Jazeera, which is on right now, if you watch Al Jazeera or like BBC or something like that, you have the sports segment. And it's like, this is all, the only sports news that they're going to have is that like somebody won a grand slam today. It's like, there's one thing interesting in sports. And like they might go a full year without reporting on baseball one time, you know, and it makes sense because these are not, you know, U.S. publications. So I would love to see a product that just like gives sports the tone that it needs. But I think that we have this fatigue of having it reported on as if it's important. Like nobody gives a shit about anybody's legacy. The problem is that many people do give a shit about people's legacy. and we're sort of being driven to kind of talk about these things over and over and over again. Just like to really, it's like, you know, if you want to like, you want to disrupt a barbershop? It's like, you know, like LeBron or Jordan. Who do you got? And you won't get a haircut. You know, it's just, and so I don't know. I just see it. It's like a matter of tone. I think it's really cool to work outside of sports. I don't always have the opportunity to do that. It's really fun. With Vice earlier this year, I got to do one of the first pieces, a documentary that was totally outside of sports. It was about a religion called Shugendo, and that was really, really fun. I would love to do more reporting on things outside of sports. I do work on, you know, a lot of things outside of it, but you know, I get lots of opportunities to work in baseball, and a lot of it, you know, sometimes when I'm on those shows, like the modality, as you're seeing here, the modality that I'm interested in with when it comes to baseball is like not the overthinking stuff and not the like analyzing decisions that are made that haven't even panned out yet. That's like mostly what you're seeing. That's like not interesting to me. I'm a decent actor. I can fake being interested in that. And I will do that for money for sure. But what I'm far more interested in are these, you know, like, what does it feel like to watch players? Like, we don't talk about that too much. We talk
about that a ton.
You know, yeah,
I think you're basically saying that Vice should hire us.
Yeah,
is your pitch.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're basically describing what we try to do with our podcast.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there are some things that I would love to see more of, but it's but yeah, the tone I think is often just a little bit difficult to kind of interface with on a regular basis. Like I'm not sure, like I don't know if I would be able to keep it up to like be on an ESPN and really be like trying to sell you this LeVar Ball story. Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's a price point that I could do it, but you know, but I don't really know. But when it comes to like player development and like making guys better and, you know, talking like I wanted to, I remember when the World Series was going on, we kept having these production meetings for a show that I was working on. And I kept saying, it's like, we have to talk about how interesting Chris Taylor's step back is. We have to talk about that. And everybody's like, not really. it's like, you know, there's, you know, and I understand that because we've created an appetite out there in the world. Like, nope, people don't want to hear it. Like, maybe people that listen to FanGraphs want to talk about that step back and talk about the first time I ever saw anybody do it was Tony Clark. First guy I ever saw do it. And I was just like, what the fuck is he doing? He's stepping backwards. This is really interesting. And like Nolan Arenado does it quite a bit. He's pretty damn good at baseball.
Yeah.
You know,
and
so
I would take him good. Would take him on my team.
Yeah. So those, you know, I'm really interested in those sorts of things, but there isn't a tremendous appetite in them. You know, imagine in the you know, the MLB Network is, you know, they're doing a little bit more of that stuff, but there isn't like a tremendous appetite for that on, you know, Fox. We have like a lot of times we have these like pseudo break it down kinds of things where it's just like a, you know, a bunch of guys like in suits swinging plastic bats and things, you know, and things like that. And that's fine. And because people like that. I mean, people like, as we know in basketball, like people like watching Shaq talk. people like watching them talk. Like, do they want to see, like, you know, basketball tutorials about, like, defensive systems? Maybe less than that. I kind of want to see that. Baseball-wise, I kind of, you know, baseball-wise, I would like to see, you know, when they sort of, like, kind of let some of the players get lost, like, a little bit down the rabbit hole of, like, how they were doing pitches. Like, when they let Pedro just go and, like, talk pitches and things like that. Yeah, love that. But, like, you know, how much do I want to see, like, some of the other things that I won't name? Like, not as much.
So we're running a bit long here, yeah. So we'll let you go in a minute. But just because we're kind of on this topic of like what fans kind of want to hear and not taking this too seriously, I got to ask about something that you mentioned a few minutes ago, which I know is something that I think every fan at one point or another has thought to themselves. And that is, what on earth are those guys talking about when the runner gets down to first base? And which, because everyone acts like they are best friends. It's like you get down there. And I don't know if you are asking about what the hell is the pitcher doing for this ritual, but I'm, or maybe it's an unspoken thing that's just like that does not leave first base. But I have always been curious.
What brilliant thing is Joey Votto saying okay, to you as you round first?
Okay. I'm gonna say a thing about myself. My lip reading skills are incredible. I don't know how they got so good, but they're incredible. Practice. I watch baseball without the sound on. I listen to music. It helps, actually. It's difficult to listen to the sound of an announcer and like do some lip reading. You can find out a lot. Two stories that I'll tell about being at first base. My favorite player to ever meet at first base is this guy named Tommy Everidge. I hope you're listening out there, Tommy. Tommy's was like one of our so 200 nice. Listeners. He's just like so nice and sweet. And like, I feel like by the time and like when I was playing against Tommy, it was in the California League. And I led the minor leagues in run scored that year. So I was always on first base, at least for a little while. And so I would run into Tommy quite a bit. And like, I feel like by the seventh inning, we were talking about relationships and stuff. You know what I mean? Like just having an absolute grand old time. Kevin Youkilis. I get to first base and Kevin Youkilis, I was like, this is the friendliest man I've ever met. Why is he being so friendly? And I'm like, is he distracting me? Cause it's working. I want to be friends with Kevin Youkilis. You know, I'm a rookie and he's Kevin Youkilis. Like I want to ask him so many questions. I don't have that much time to ask him these questions. So that was like a really good time. And I'm thinking, he's distracting me. Or something, he like knows I want to steal. World Series. I didn't play in the World Series except for when very casually Joe Maddon in the top of the ninth inning of game 5, he said, hey, you should go run for Navi. And I'm like, okay, it's a World Series. getting ready to go in there. And I said to him, I was like, do you want me to steal? Like just like that. He's like, yeah. Duh. Like he didn't say duh, but like he looked at me like I was like, of course I want you to steal.
I know, Joe Maddon look comes across quite often on TV.
And my thinking is just like, but Joe, everybody's gonna know, you know. So anyway,
it's like you're fast for a reason.
Yeah, I trot out there and Ryan Howard's there. And Ryan Howard is just being suspiciously friendly. And I'm like, he's trying to distract me. There's so much time to talk. Like, if he wants to be friends, he could text me. He can get my number. He can just meet me at the, you know, after the game. He was absolutely trying, I think, to distract me. But it was Ryan Howard. So, like, I couldn't ignore him. That would just be rude. I couldn't. So, I was like, trying to take my lead, like, look at the sign. Like, I thought I was doing a million things at once. Like, I thought I was going to pass out because I was still trying to, like, be friendly to Ryan Howard. Like, I think that's what he was doing. So, there's a lot of that going on. But also, too. Remember, even in a team sport like soccer, you could acknowledge that a player on your team is an insane person. And baseball's not that much of a team sport, and especially when it comes to like the, you know, the pitchers and the position players, cats and dogs, it's like the eternal fight in baseball. So a lot of the time when the guy gets to first base, they're just talking about the pitcher and like what's going on with him today or whatever. You know, there's some first basemen that they're just like, they're such hitters. Like they don't give a shit. Like they don't care that their team, like that you just gave up a hit that may lead to a run. You know, like you get there and just like, nice hit, man. You're looking great. Like you know, like there's a lot of that. Like, whoo, that swing is looking bueno, dude. Like there's a lot of that going on. So much of that going on. But there's a lot of just talking about like weird stuff that happened in the game, because weird things happen in the game and they get kind of like covered up. Like somebody, like, you know, like, oh man, like, you know, when somebody does something crazy and like you think something might happen, like problem guys on teams that just cause all sorts of problems. So there's a lot of talking about that, but it's you can do a lot of lip reading, but it can be almost everything. There are some guys that are, you know, they're talkers, and then other guys that like they'd never even look at you. They'd just slap a hard tag on you, throw it back. They'd never even acknowledge you. You know, they're like really in football mode. Like, I hate you. I hate you. We're not friends. And what I love,
you're standing around in the same airspace.
And to end, what I would say is, to me, so the fraternization rule. You know that this is a thing. When I was in AA, I'll bring up Carlos Gonzalez, Emilio Bonifacio, Cesar Nicholas. He works with the Mariners. A bunch of really great players on that team. I remember Faye Scherzer over there in AA. Great players on that team. We played them all the time. I played against those guys in A-ball, AA. And we were all friends. Franklin Morales. You know, like, I broke up Franklin Morales's no-hitter, and, like, we went out for dinner. Like, so we're all friends, you know, we're all friends. There's really no reason. You get guys that played with each other in college and stuff like that. Everybody's friends. And so there's a rain delay and Brett Butler's their manager and we're in the outfield and it's like, you know, me and, you know, Bonifacio are like hugging and dancing. We're all like hanging out and Brett Butler beelines to us. He's like, what are you guys doing? You're not supposed to do this. Like, you're not supposed to do this. Like, when the gates are open, you're not supposed to, like, be friendly. And I just remember, and he walked away, and I was just like, damn, Brett, you need a hug. Brett. Like, Brett, it's fine. Like, who hurt you? You know? But it's just
I feel
because,
like, that's Brett Gardner.
It's just
now.
Because in his day, it's just, like, not what was done. But what is so fascinating about this is that as much as has been said about Latin players, who is bucking the fraternization rule? It's all Latin players. The best baseball TV that I've seen in years is Baez and Lindor screwing around at second base. Now, the fraternization rule, I think, has helped. Like, you have all these moments where that are almost like the fraternization rule has to go, because it's like, what do you do when you have a play under review and you have two guys standing on second base, like looking at the Jumbotron? Are they supposed to like stand away from each other? They both need to stand like around the base. So it's really, you know, that is sort of interesting. And I love it. I think it's awesome. Like, you can compete really, really hard and like be around each other. And really, in general, the biggest divide is position players and pitchers. So
yeah, there was like that beautiful moment in the NLCS when Baez, I think, like miraculously tagged out Puig, as he does, and then just like waved his finger at him, just like, give me
beautiful.
All of this, all
get
of the
all
time.
Of that, all the time, all of it, all the time. Yes, my favorite player ever. He is the most aesthetically pleasing player that I've ever seen. He is incredible.
All right, well, Fernando, we don't want to steal too much more of your time. We're already well past what we said we would do, but it was a blast. Where can we find some of your non-baseball playing work?
I don't share much of it, but that could change in 2018, perhaps. But if you happen to be between 15 and 18, I teach at the School of the New York Times. Related to this, I teach a class called Modern Sports Trends. Pretty good time. It'll cost you, but it's a pretty good time. I teach a creative writing course for them. I also teach a sports called Modern Sports Trends. What else am I up to? That's all. Just a lot of balls up in the air. A lot of maybe. Working on a thing with Deadspin. Working on a thing. Working on stuff with Vice. Working on stuff with MLB. I talk to people. I flirt with the Blue Jays. I have interesting conversations with Tony Clark, a.k.a. Baseball Morpheus. You know, I don't know what 2018 has in store, but right, that's
well,
exciting.
Does any of us
at
really?
At least it's a wide net of stuff where we could catch you in. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Of course,
really, really
it's been a great time.
This was awesome. Yeah.
That was a long one.
Yeah, I remember like being in the middle of the interview. So we recorded this like Thursday the 14th, and I just remember looking down at the clock from time to time and looking down at how long we were recording for. And we started to get into like the hour 20 range, and I was like, this is going to be two podcasts.
Yeah, but I was like noticing the time. I was like, first of all, we were way over what we asked him to do for us. But how many times you get an opportunity like this, right? I was like, I just have to, it's like one more question. It's got to be one more. Like, I got to know.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. How often are you sitting in a former MLB player's basement just like asking
just
him
like,
questions
just
about like
chilling.
Asking him what it's like when you round first base and the first baseman turns back and starts talking to you? Like,
yeah.
That's very
smack on the butt. How are the kids?
Yeah, especially with someone who's like who's willing to talk just the way that he is. So yeah. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, so really huge thanks to Fernando just for taking the time and really being willing to entertain all of our smart and silly questions. I think we really had a wonderful time doing this.
Yeah, so maybe we'll get Fernando in the studio. We'll do a little hum and hum with him at some point.
We got to get him in our element now.
That was Tipping Pitches. I'm Bobby Wagner.
I'm Alex Baisley.
And thank you for listening. Check back in next week.